Hello and welcome to Beyond the Filter, a podcast about censorship. I'm Brandy.
And I'm Jeremy.
And today we're talking about the world first social media minimum age law that's just been introduced in Australia. Since the 10th of December, social media platforms have been required to block Australian under 16s from using their services or face hefty fines. Around 96% of Australian kids aged 10 to 15 use social media. So this isn't a niche rule. It's going to touch almost every family in the country. But this policy raises a much bigger question than just, should 14-year-olds have Instagram? It forces us to think about free expression, government power, platform responsibility, parental responsibility, and how societies protect kids without accidentally building the infrastructure of soft authoritarianism.
The new rules come from the Online Safety Amendment Social Media Minimum Age Bill 2024, which inserts a new Part 4A into Australia's Online Safety Act. So from 10 December 2025, platforms that exist primarily to enable social integration between two or more users, like TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, Snapchat, Twitter, and Reddit, will be legally classified as age-restricted social media platforms. However, things like messaging apps, emails, and online gaming are currently excluded. Services with the primary purpose of supporting the health and education of users have also been excluded. So these platforms must take reasonable steps to prevent under-16s from creating accounts and using existing accounts. The law doesn't specify exactly what those steps must be, but failure to comply can result in civil penalties of up to $50 million Australian for systemic breaches. There are no penalties for children or parents. Enforcement pressure is directed entirely at the platforms, and enforcement responsibilities are shared between the eSafety Commissioner and the Office of the Australian Information Commissioner, which oversees privacy. So that's the basic shape of the law.
Australia has spent the last decade expanding the powers of the eSafety Commissioner, Australia's government office dedicated to online harm. The Online Safety Act 2021 dramatically broadened that office's authority. It can order the removal of cyberbullying, violent materials, image-based abuse, and content judged harmful to children. The government has also been very clear about its ambitions. It wants Australia to be a global model for controlling online harms and expects other countries to copy its approach.
Just to jump in with some context here, the eSafety Commissioner has been a little controversial as to just how conservative it is. Back in 2021, the eSafety Commissioner appeared on a US anti-porn podcast produced by the National Center on Sexual Exploitation, a group which used to be called Morality in Media. It's an extremely conservative group with religious backing that regularly calls out mainstream magazines, retailers, and media companies for being associated with pornography. Believe it or not, they even included LinkedIn on their Dirty Dozen list because Pornhub has a LinkedIn account. So for the eSafety Commissioner to associate with such a conservative group has caused a bit of a stir. So I was wondering, Brandy, can responsibility for the social media ban be placed solely with the eSafety Commissioner?
Well, no, this isn't happening in a vacuum. For about 10 years now, governments around the world have been watching a growing body of research about what heavy social media use is doing to children and teenagers. And several key concerns keep showing up. Mental health concerns, cyberbullying, online grooming and sexual exploitation, as well as radicalization and extremism. We'll talk a bit about each of those. Mental health is probably the strongest political driver behind the minimum age proposals. A 2024 umbrella review of systematic studies found consistent associations between heavier social media use and higher rates of depression, anxiety, sleep disturbance, and lower life satisfaction in adolescents. The effects are often small at the individual level, but when applied across entire populations, they become significant. A 2025 narrative review in the Journal of Adolescent Health noted that most robust findings show a dose-response pattern. The more problematic or compulsive the use is, the stronger the correlation with depressive and anxiety symptoms. One striking US study found that preteens who owned smartphones at 12 had higher risks of depression, obesity, and inadequate sleep compared with peers who didn't. None of this proves social media causes mental illness on its own, but policymakers don't wait for laboratory perfect causal maps. They act on patterns.
So a second big motivator, of course, is cyberbullying, which has gone from emerging problem to standard teen experience. A large 2023 survey of US students found that well over half of girls and about half of boys had experienced cyberbullying at some point, with roughly one in four bullied just in the past month. Other data shows that about 15% of high school students are cyberbullied in a given year, with much higher rates for girls and LGBTQ plus students. Bullying itself isn't new. I certainly experienced a lot of it when I was in school, and that was well before the internet was a thing.
Same here.
But the argument is that near-universal smartphone access makes it constant and inescapable. It follows kids into their bedrooms and through the night. That adds pressure on regulators to step in.
Then there's the more serious and politically charged category, online sexual exploitation and grooming. In the UK, police have recently recorded more than 7,000 offences of sexual communication with a child in a single year, the highest number since the office was introduced, and representing an 89% increase since 2017 to 18. A large share of cases where the platform was identified involved mainstream services such as Snapchat, which accounted for around 48% of disclosed cases. Australia is experiencing a similar trend. Australian Centre to Counter Child Exploitation reported a 41% jump in online child sexual exploitation reports in the 2024 to 2025 financial year, receiving 82,764 reports, up from the 58,000 of the previous year. Globally, the scale is even more alarming. A landmark 2024 synthesis by the Childline Global Child Safety Institute estimates that roughly 1 in 8 children worldwide, about 302 million, experience some form of online sexual exploitation or unwanted sexual solicitation in a single year. For lawmakers, this adds up to a straightforward political argument. If mainstream digital platforms have become major vectors of online child sexual exploitation, then declining to regulate children's access is no longer viewed as a neutral or passive stance.
I've said before that the two issues that always stand behind proposals to regulate the internet are child exploitation and terrorism. So it's not surprising that a fourth pillar behind the move to ban social media for under 16s is concern about youth radicalization. According to a 2025 summary of the Europol EU Terrorism Situation and Trend Report, online platforms, including social media, messaging apps, gaming environments, and video sharing platforms, remain pivotal enablers of propaganda, radicalization, and recruitment by violent extremist groups. In many cases, the report notes, these groups exploit algorithm-driven content recommendation, meme culture, gaming communities, and hybrid online gaming social media ecosystems to reach young, isolated, or vulnerable individuals. European research networks and policymakers echo this urgency. The Radicalization Awareness Network, RAN, and broader EU-level prevention frameworks highlight that low-friction sharing, immersive social interaction, community features and virality on mainstream digital platforms significantly lower the barriers to stumbling into extremist content, particularly for adolescents and young adults. Again, social media doesn't flip a switch and turn a child into an extremist, but the argument is that it does make certain journeys easier, faster, and more networked.
Add all that together, mental health correlations, cyberbullying prevalence, surging grooming offences and extremism risks, and you get a political landscape where doing nothing becomes almost impossible. In Australia's case, it already has one of the most powerful online safety regulators in the world. It has embraced a world leader posture on digital regulation, and it faced sustained public pressure from parents and child safety advocates to do something about social media. So the minimum age law isn't a bolt from the blue. It's a culmination of decades of accumulating evidence, headlines, and public anxiety.
So when the Australian government justifies the social media minimum age law, the logic looks like this. It harms under 16s disproportionately, especially in mental health, sexual exploitation, and bullying. Platforms haven't adequately self-regulated. Age gates are easy to lie through and reporting tools don't scale. Parents aren't using parental controls consistently and many feel overwhelmed. Social media is now woven into adolescence, so it impacts most Australian minors. And if the state has a duty to protect children, minimum age access control becomes a necessary intervention. So we'll get to the counter arguments later, but you can see from a politician's perspective how this adds up. And public polling has given them political cover. National surveys found around 3/4 of Australians supported the specific proposal to ban under 16s from social media, with strong backing for tougher penalties on non-compliant companies. Other polling has showed very high support for some form of age and identity verification to protect minors.
So I actually spoke to someone who works for the Labor Party earlier this year around the election, and I did ask them about this. Like, they were someone who worked for one of the MPs, and I asked them about what was going on with the media law, and they basically said, yeah, this is just to make the parents happy. We're just hearing so much that every time we talk to people and ask what their number one issues are, when it's a parent, it's almost, get our kids off social media, get our kids off social media, do something. And we're like, yeah, all right, this is what we're doing.
I was going to say that, yeah, it's definitely not a vote-winning measure for children, but children don't vote, right?
Yeah, exactly.
They're literally disenfranchised. So this is aimed squarely at parents. And so the narrative here is that there's a big evidence base creating rising public pressure, which creates a political opportunity, which leads to legal intervention. And that leads us straight into the central debate, which is
this protection or is this censorship? On the protection side, the government appeals to the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, arguing it is obligated to protect minors from harmful online environments. And the ban is presented as a delay rather than a permanent exclusion, a way to give kids a few more years of development before entering adult spaces. On the censorship side, the law restricts freedom of expression and access to information for 13 to 15-year-olds, many of whom are politically aware, socially engaged, and dependent on digital communities. Human rights lawyers warn about overblocking, where platforms remove content and accounts aggressively to avoid huge fines, sweeping up lawful speech in the process. This tension runs through the whole policy.
So I don't think you can generalize, but there are certainly going to be differential impacts on different groups of kids. Some kids, yes, they may benefit from reduced exposure to self-harm content, violent videos, pornography, and targeted manipulation. They may also benefit from having less social media time during their crucial development years. But on the other hand, many teens, particularly LGBTQ youth and those with mental health struggles, find online communities to be lifelines, offering support they can't easily find offline. Blocking them from access may worsen their isolation. The other thing is, teenagers are extremely adept at working around restrictions. So there are early examples of kids passing as much older using face age systems or simply moving to VPNs and burner accounts. So the ban may actually push young people towards less regulated or more toxic platforms rather than reducing their overall risk.
I was at the cinema the other day watching Zootopia 2 by myself, and I was sitting next to a mother of two young children, and the ad came up on the before the movie saying that the social media ban was coming up, and I was like, oh yeah, I wonder how that's gonna go. And the mother next to me was just like, oh, they're just gonna find a way around it. They always do. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, technically the law applies to all social platforms, including anonymous boards like 4chan style sites, but in practice, those fringe sites are unlikely to comply. They often have no corporate presence in Australia, they resist moderation efforts, and they have business models built on anonymity. We've also seen, as I wrote in an article for The Guardian recently that I'll include in the show notes, that there's recently been an explosion of interest in the Tor network, which, as we know, is an essentially uncensorable part of the internet that people are increasingly turning to when their access is locked down. And that's a problem because the Tor network is one of the only places where CSAM isn't able to be censored. So it creates a potential paradox. Some of the most toxic spaces may remain available to young people, while mainstream platforms that are safer become more heavily fenced off. So the net outcome for children's well-being is uncertain.
The next piece of this puzzle is enforcement, because this is where a kid's safety story becomes an adult privacy and free speech story as well. The law doesn't specify one magic technology. Instead, it requires platforms to use age assurance, any process that can reliably distinguish users who are over or under 16. The Australian privacy regulator groups age assurance into three broad categories. One, age verification, using official documents or data sources such as government-issued IDs, like a driver's license or passport, to confirm a user's date of birth. Two, age estimation, using technologies like facial analysis, biometric or statistical techniques, or online behavioral or usage data. Or three, age inference, using contextual, behavioral, transactional, or environmental signals, such as account age, usage patterns, metadata, and connections, rather than formal identity documents or biometric data. On top of that, platforms can either build these systems themselves or outsource them to third-party age assurance providers. Crucial point is, almost all users, regardless of age, will experience some form of age check. Adults don't get a free pass. Let's look at the main methods of what they mean for adults. Government ID, facial recognition, behavioral estimation, and third-party verification services. I'll talk about those one by one. So, government ID. The most obvious method is age verification via government ID, uploading a photo of your driver's license, passport, or another official document so a system can confirm your date of birth. There is an important safeguard. Platforms are not allowed to require government ID as the only option. They must offer at least one reasonable alternative. But in practice, if your other options fail or you get flagged as uncertain, government ID becomes a de facto way to unlock your account. Real-world examples already exist. Some major platforms use ID-based verification as a fallback when automated systems can't confirm your age. For adults, this has several consequences. Loss of anonymity or pseudonymity. Tying accounts to official ID makes it much harder to maintain alternative identities, a problem for whistleblowers, activists, queer users in hostile environments, and anyone who just prefers not to link every post to their legal name. Data breach and misuse risk. Government IDs are extremely valuable targets for hackers. The more platforms and third-party vendors storing scans of licenses and passports, the more tempting the ecosystem becomes. Digital exclusion. Adults who lack up-to-date ID or whose documentation is in limbo may find it much harder to access mainstream social media platforms. Cross-border data flows. Many age verification vendors are based overseas, meaning ID scans may be processed and sometimes stored in other jurisdictions with different privacy rules.
A second method is facial age estimation. Show the camera your face and an algorithm estimates your age or age range. So regulators define this as using biometric analysis and AI to predict age from physical characteristics. In practice, users are often asked to take a short video selfie that's analyzed by an external provider. So trials and real-world deployments show that age estimation is technically feasible and already used in several sectors, but accuracy drops near legal thresholds and is less reliable for darker skin tones and for people aged roughly 16 to 20, exactly the band that this law cares about. So for adults, the consequences of this are, you know, normalization of biometric scanning. Even if the platforms promise to only store a yes or no result, they still process faces through biometric algorithms. And there are real concerns about that. We've seen law enforcement misusing these biometric algorithms to target people by racial group. So it does create discrimination. Adults who look young or who belong to groups that the systems struggle with may be repeatedly challenged or forced into extra checks or misclassified. And it creates false positives, which can lock people out. Systems will often use a buffer zone around the threshold age to avoid letting minors slip through. But that, of course, increases the risk of wrongly blocking adults. And knowing that you may be asked for periodic biometric selfies just to keep your account can make platforms feel less like public squares and more like control checkpoints. Again, you also have to wonder about how successful this will be against determined kids. I've heard that minors will just get an older brother or sister to sit in front of the camera so they can get their verification done.
Then the most subtle category is age inference, guessing age based on behavior rather than faces or documents. Regulatory guidelines describe this as using contextual, behavioral, transactional, or environmental signals. For example, how long the account has existed, which content it interacts with, the language and style of posts, when the user is active, connections with other users who appear to be under 16, and membership in youth-focused groups. In other words, does the account behave like a teenager? For adults, this can mean always-on profiling. Even if you've never asked to upload your ID or selfie, your behavior is constantly analyzed to decide which age bucket you belong in. Misclassifications of adults with youth-coded behavior. Adults who engage heavily in fandom spaces, gaming, team-heavy communities, or just use slang and memes maybe get treated as suspiciously young. So it's not good news for my Zootopia going to the movies alone ass.
I was going to say, yeah. I know, yeah. Transformers is another of your big fandoms. And there's so many adults who are into Disney, Harry Potter, My Little Pony, and other typically young fandoms. So how might this affect the way that adults engage online?
Yeah. These people aren't already like, the ageism online really annoys me, but that's a whole other thing I can make a podcast about. Anyway, so yeah, the chilling effects on engagement. If people start to suspect that liking certain content, joining certain groups, or posting a certain style might trigger extra verification hoops, they may change how they behave online. In turn, this could negatively impact on creators who make content considered childish, such as toy review channels, for example. And then there's pressure against data minimization. Regulators recommend collecting a little data as necessary, but from a business perspective, the more data usually means better models. That tension is unresolved.
So rather than doing all of this age checking themselves, platforms may elect to outsource their age checks to specialist age assurance companies. Regulators explicitly permit this. Platforms can rely on external vendors for ID checks or facial estimation or both. Some vendors advertise privacy-preserving designs, for example, systems where the platform never sees your ID and the vendor never learns which site you're trying to access, using token-based confirmations instead of raw data sharing. These designs are technically possible, but they aren't mandatory. So for adults, this means more entities knowing who you are. Instead of just trusting the platform, you now have to trust the platform, the age assurance provider, and often a cloud infrastructure behind them. And there have been cases where data has been leaked by an identity provider. Just this year, Discord's provider was breached, which exposed personal details from 70,000 users, including users from Australia. Also, it's an opaque black box. Most people will have no idea which vendor is being used, what data they store, where it's processed, or how long it's kept. And there's the danger of scope creep. Once you have an ecosystem of age assurance providers, it becomes easy to reuse that infrastructure for other purposes. Gambling, adult content, news access, even government services.
So in practice, platforms are unlikely to rely on just one method. They will layer low-friction behavioral inference in the background, biometric or other checks when accounts are flagged as uncertain, and age ID verification as a final option if all else fails. For adults, that adds up to several big shifts. You're no longer assumed to be an adult by default. If the system can't be sure, you're treated as a potential child until you prove otherwise. Anonymity and a pseudonymity harder to maintain. Certain groups and behaviors will encounter more friction than others, and most importantly, the infrastructure for age gating becomes normalized, and once it exists, it can be repurposed for broader access control. The intended target is under 16s, but the practical impact extends to everyone.
There's another enforcement dynamic to consider as well, overcompliance. When you tell platforms to take reasonable steps to protect children and then threaten them with multi-million-dollar fines and give a powerful regulator the ability to order takedowns and blocking, you create very strong incentives to err on the side of deletion. We've already seen this under other parts of the Online Safety Act. In high-profile cases involving violent content, platforms have geo-blocked URLs for Australian users and still faced pressure for broader action. Fines for non-compliance with transparency obligations can accumulate rapidly. So if you're a platform lawyer looking at that landscape, the lesson is simple. When in doubt, take it down, and sometimes take it down everywhere. I guess the best-known example of this is when the eSafety Commissioner attempted to take down a stabbing video from X, not only for Australia, but worldwide. And Elon Musk fought her in the federal court until she eventually dropped the demand. I'm not a big Elon Musk fan, but I have to say that I agree.
I mean, yeah, I like broken clock, I guess, yeah.
But in this case, he was right. Yeah. Like, it was an overreaching demand. Nobody appointed the eSafety Commissioner as the global internet censor.
Yeah.
So human rights bodies have warned for years that these kind of regimes create chilling effects. Intermediaries acting as de facto speech police over-remove lawful content to stay out of trouble. Users also learn to self-censor because the boundaries of acceptable become unpredictable. Similar patterns are emerging under the EU's Digital Services Act, where some services contemplate geo-blocking entire regions or radically tightening moderation to avoid risk. So in Australia, overcompliance could look like more aggressive takedowns of anything that might be interpreted as harmful to minors, even if adults have a legitimate interest in accessing it. We could also see broad geo-blocking of content for Australian users, rather than narrowly targeting specific illegal posts. And we could see the quiet demotion of lawful but sensitive material. Graphic news reporting, controversial political speech, queer content, because the risk calculus for platforms has changed. Even if you're a completely law-abiding adult, you feel this indirectly. Your feed gets blander. Certain topics stop surfacing. Some links don't open. You might have to use VPNs just to see material that's freely available elsewhere. So that's the paradox. In trying to protect kids from the worst of the internet, we also make it much easier, technically and politically, to shrink what adults are allowed to see.
So if this is all about kids, why not rely more heavily on parents and parental controls? Surveys show that many parents underutilize parental control tools on their children's devices. About half of parents use parental controls on smartphones, tablets, or social accounts, and even fewer do so on game consoles. Usage is often inconsistent, with some parents applying controls on certain devices or accounts, not others. Studies and reports suggest that several contributing factors: complexity and fragmentation. Many parental controls are confusing, difficult to configure, or buried in device settings, discouraging consistent use. Reliance on informal strategies. Rather than using technical tools consistently, many parents monitor their children informally by checking devices, knowing passwords, or talking regularly, and perceived effort and effectiveness. Some parents find tool time consuming or less effective, leading them to apply them selectively. The research also indicates that parents are aware of online risks such as inappropriate content, cyberbullying, or overuse, yet feel the technical responsibility falls disproportionately on them. While qualitative evidence suggests parents sometimes feel less tech-savvy than their children or experience conflict enforcing restrictions, large-scale qualitative data on these motivations remain limited. Overall, the evidence shows that while parental controls exist, uptake is incomplete and uneven, highlighting the need for more accessible tools and additional support from tech companies and policymakers.
So before wrapping up, it's worth asking, was a hard under 16 ban the only option? Most experts would say no. Around the world, child rights bodies, academics, and some regulators argue that we already have plenty of alternatives that protect kids without excluding them from the digital public square. Some of those options include safety by design, which means instead of banning kids from social media, we redesign the platforms to be less harmful by default, having safer privacy settings, fewer manipulative patterns, reduced late night notifications, and algorithms that don't aggressively push doom scrolling. The focus here is safety first, rights preserved, not safety by removing the child entirely. Another thing we could do is to have targeted age checks for high-risk content. That way, we would tighten age verification for the most dangerous categories, like extreme pornography and violence, rather than every form of social interaction. That's close to the current model in the UK, although that may change as other countries start adopting Australia's approach. So the idea there would be to shield kids from the worst content without cutting them off from friends, communities, and support networks. Another option is parental consent models. So some jurisdictions explore systems where under 16s can join platforms only if a parent verifies and approves. This keeps agency closer to the family rather than the state and recognizes that not all teens, all circumstances are the same. And additionally, we have a lot of existing laws that could be enforced before inventing new bans. So governments could simply enforce existing safety, privacy, and child protection laws more consistently. So from this perspective, the problem isn't a lack of rules, but weak enforcement and under-resourced regulators. Finally, many experts would say that digital literacy for both kids and parents is one of the most powerful tools available. Children and teens who are taught how platforms work, how manipulation and grooming operate, and how to report abuse are better able to navigate complex online spaces. Teachers groups and child rights bodies in Australia have said the same thing. Bans might reduce exposure, but education reduces vulnerability. We also need to think about who gets to have a say. As I mentioned earlier, young people don't vote, but they can be given input into governments. Research groups have emphasized that young people themselves should be a part of developing policy, not just the ones that it's imposed upon. When teens are involved, the solutions tend to be more realistic, less punitive, and more respectful of their rights.
Australia's social media age ban is ambitious and arguably well-intentioned. It's also risky, complicated, and potentially precedent-setting. The goal, protecting kids, is almost universally shared. The real question is how to do it without eroding the rights of teenagers or the freedom of adults along the way. As this law rolls out, we'll find out what bends first, the platforms, the politics, or public trust.
That's it for this episode of Beyond the Filter. Tune in again next month for another look at censorship online and fandom and all of the other things that we love to talk about. So that's goodbye from me.
And thank you for listening.